Welcome to The Independent with Scott Atlas by The Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to important issues facing our society today. Today's guest is Kim Strassel. Kim is an award-winning journalist, editorial writer, author, and mother. She is a member of the editorial board for The Wall Street Journal. She writes important editorials as well as the weekly Potomac Watch political column, and on TV, she is a regular contributor to TV news and political shows, including CBS's Face the Nation, Fox News Sunday, NBC's Meet the Press, and the Journal Editorial Report. She's the author of The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech, which chronicles recent attacks on conservative nonprofits, businesses, and donors. An Oregon native, Kim earned a bachelor's degree in public policy international affairs from Princeton University, and she now lives in Alaska with her three children. She and I have an insightful conversation about the role of America's legacy in social media and its transformation over the past several years, especially relating to the Trump election. We talk about censorship and her views on what happens next, both politically and as American media evolves. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Okay, Kim Strassel, welcome.
Well, so great to be here, Scott.
Really, thanks for squeezing us in between your outings and your eagle sightings up in Alaska there.
It can keep you busy. A lot
right.
of eagles.
So I actually sort of wanted to talk in the beginning of this about your pathway, because I think I want to, in part, inspire good people to pursue journalism and reporting and the media. I think we really need better, more reliable young people who are super smart going into it. So you're an inspiration. And I sort of wanted to ask, I know you went to Princeton and got a degree in international affairs. So can you trace a little bit of how you became interested in being in journalism?
I'd always loved writing, Scott. And I have to be honest, I was one of those kids that as I neared the end of university, I did not know what I wanted to do. And was going to do what all kids do when they don't know what else to do, which is just keep studying, because I knew I was good at that. So I decided to apply to law schools. And then I got some really amazing advice from a couple of mentors who happened to be in the Princeton area. And in fact, they're quite notable in the journalism world, Peter Kahn and Karen Elliott House, who were senior members of Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal. And I worked for them after school watching their kids. And they said, don't go be a lawyer just because you can be a lawyer. Take a year out. And I ended up getting an internship at the Wall Street Journal. And I've been there for more than 30 years.
Wow.
But, you know, the one thing I can't agree with you more. I love the idea of getting more people into journalism. And I think one of the things that helped me more than anything was coming from a different environment than a lot of people who go into journalism. That's my belief of what's wrong with journalism. We have a lot of like-minded kids who all grow up in the same kind of like-minded world. And I grew up in a logging community in Oregon, and it gives you a very different perspective on the world and the people around you.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think this is... It is true that, you know, we have good people in journalism, but and we'll talk about this quite a bit, but there's been a dramatic loss of trust in information in the field, and the check on power, at least when I was a kid, were the investigative reporting kind of things. And it's frightening, and I think it's very relevant to what's happened today. So I want to talk about specifically in this realm, the media from a sort of a different angle, because I like to think of it as the impact of the media, in using the term largely, on the election of Donald Trump. I feel like it was instrumental perhaps in explaining what happened, because the media coverage from a non-media person's view, myself, of Trump was clearly not objective. And in a way, I think you could say the same thing about the coverage of Joe Biden. It was obvious that he was not physically, mentally capable. And I'm a doctor involved in neurologic diseases, but you didn't have to be a doctor to see that. But there was a cover up in the coverage of Kamala Harris. And I'm sort of wondering if the coverage of the media created by the media created a backlash because they were telling people lies that people with common sense sort of understood were lies. And I think it may have created more voting for Trump.
I could not agree with you more. And in fact, I think this all comes back to what you said about the job that the media is supposed to have to be a check on government. And I think it goes beyond just a backlash. I do think that that was a huge part of this election, that some people just decided, A, that they were going to tune out traditional media and they began to get their information from other sources where they felt that they were getting the real deal, whether it might be a Joe Rogan podcast or some other influencer online. I think that that was one thing. I actually go deeper, though. I would argue, Scott, that the single biggest culprit, if Democrats want to ask themselves why they flamed in this election, was the media. Because this is what happens when the media doesn't do its job. It exists to be a check on power, as you noted.
Right.
And it exists to be a mirror as a way, a guardrails on the elected class. And when you fail to do that as an industry in the media, and you just tell Democrats what they want to hear, I don't doubt that if I was a Democrat reading most of the leading press the 2 months going into the election, they probably did think that most of the country was so thrilled to be soon to have Kamala Harris's joy in everything. And they were legitimately surprised when that didn't happen on election day. But this is what the media just told them what they wanted to hear, because they wanted to see Kamala Harris elected. And they weren't getting those guardrails. They weren't getting that feedback.
Right. I mean, it was sort of shocking. And, you know, we I think you and I are probably similar in that we watch the news, we listen, we read, we're very involved. I think most people don't have that sort of time, really, frankly. But that's my job and that's your job, although for different reasons. But it does say, I think, you know, the importance of social media. I you know, it's very surprising to me the initial phase of social media. In my view, social media was going to be the savior, the wow, it's fantastic. It allows all this information, the more information, the better. And then it became a tool of censorship. Because once people became dependent on social media, in my view, my opinion is that it became easier to manipulate people because it blocked, if that is the town square, and you only allow one side to be visible on that town square, you've not only created the sense that there's a false consensus, you've marginalized everybody with a differing point of view. I mean, this happened during COVID quite a bit to me personally, but others as well. And, you know, social media has now, though, I think evolving to me, in my opinion, with Musk buying Twitter was a really critical part of this. And, you know, as we know, and there's an interesting statistic that, you know, newspapers have been going out of fashion for 20 years. I mean, there's numbers here. I'm looking at the latest information that I had, which was in 2004, 55 million daily weekday newspapers was the circulation, 55 million in the United States. And by 2022, that was less than half, 20 million. I mean, it's really sort of shocking. So, first of all, I'd like to hear what you think about why that is, because that sort of 2004 is when social media became starting really with Facebook and everything. But I mean, it really wasn't a big part of people's lives, I don't think. You know, what happened? Has there been an undermining of trust even back then, or what do you think?
Well, first of all, I agree with you. I shiver to think about how close we came to full-on censorship under this last administration, the efforts that were made. And I really think that to the extent that we are seeing some positive change now, for instance, Facebook saying that it's going to stop relying on these so-called fact checkers and move more to community notes the way that Elon Musk has set up Twitter, or X, I should say. It really does. I think we're so lucky that he stepped up in the name of free speech to buy that place and set a new model, because the only thing more scary than social media saying that they are going to censor what goes online is government saying, we're going to tell you what goes online. And we were headed that way. I think if there hadn't been some, and by the way, I don't think either side has a monopoly on good intentions in that regard. I didn't like to hear people in Congress talking about changing Section 230 or engaging in sort of widespread changes in what could be said or done on social media, whether it was on the Republican side or on the Democratic side. Government should not be in the business of saying what kind of speech you should engage in.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. I think this is very important because, you know, there's a sad part of people who are given power is that then they feel they can use it for whatever they want. And I think we're going to see that I'm concerned we might see that in this administration as well, with some of the nominees that maybe we'll talk about. But just because you have power, you know, I'm much more on the libertarian side of things. Regardless of social issues, the solution to, quote, misinformation is obviously only more information.
Correct.
No one can be trusted with the truth.
Yes, and especially not government. Government official who comes and tells you on either side of the aisle, we're going to do this, but it'll be for good reasons. No, if you are scared of what people are putting online or you are using that as your argument for why you need to control it, beware. But, you know, you asked a question about what happened to traditional print newspapers. And look, that business model has been struggling for a long time, and it's very complex. It does have to do with more competition in social media and online, which I think that a lot of people in the press were very slow to realize and understand that they weren't just competing with each other anymore. They were competing with a new format. It has to do with the problem of print advertising, the end of classified ads, which were an enormous source of revenue for a lot of newspapers over the time. But I think part of the problem here now, and to the extent you do see an acceleration in some ways, is that also people got caught up with clicks. How do I make people come to my site? And they moved away from the notion that what people want is quality news that they can trust. A guard dog of government, for instance, not necessarily hysteria and hype and all the things that too many, I think, in the business think are what you need to do to be successful and get people to come and read your stuff.
So do you think that there's a rethinking of that? In other words, I mean, for you know, you're obviously on the inside, and I know Wall Street Journal is a print, but also clearly online revenue source in a variety of ways, and TV. I wonder, though, are they realizing this? They, meaning the people who are in charge of the business side, that people actually are now really hungry. If it's true what you say, and I agree with you, they're hungry for actually true reporting, honest reporting, rather than the sensationalistic editorialized stuff.
I get asked all the time, Scott. It's funny, when I go out, people say to me, and by the way, I'm immensely proud of my newspaper. I think it sticks to that mission of quality information that people get. But I get people all the time that say to me, you know, other than the Wall Street Journal, like, where can I just go to get straight up news? I mean, there's this
right.
hunger, this desire for it all the time. And it's hard because so few outlets do it. I think the other thing that's really missing these days in our environment, and I think it's hurt our body politic, is that unfortunately, a lot of those news outlets that went away were the ones that covered local government and local affairs and local news. And people are desperate to do that. I think it's been unhealthy for this country because we are, and I know you appreciate this, we are a nation of 50 states. And our first form of government is, in fact, the one closest to us, which is our state. And in the absence of quality information and interest in what's happening at that local level of government, people obsess on what is going on in Washington. And we need to care about what is going on in Washington. But if you think about your day-to-day, like how your schools are run, whether your trash is picked up, whether the potholes are filled in your roads, all of those things come down to your local government. And you have a far greater ability to impact what happens there. But first, you have to know what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is very interesting, particularly when you talk about trust in media. There's obviously, I think we all know, we don't have to read the surveys to say that trust in media has plummeted, but there's a couple of interesting points in that survey data, one of which is that the trust in local news, although it's fallen somewhat, it's not fallen that much compared to the trust in national news. And I think it points to what you're saying, which is it's not just very important to your life, but it's also something you rely on. I happen to have a 97-year-old mother-in-law, and she watches the local news, and there's actually quite a bit of national coverage in there. But people have sort of abandoned that, or at least it seems that people have abandoned that to become this sort of federally focused, obsessive sort of news reporting on things that aren't necessarily directly relevant to people's lives.
Yeah, and you know, I think the reason that people have retained more trust in what local news that they get is that to the extent you have it out there, it does tend to be much more straightforward, right? In that people aren't seeking all the time to sensationalize it, to suggest that there are Russian collusion plots involved with it or what have you. It's much more, you know, the council met today and it decided this and that. And people want to hear that. They want to know, you know, what was the school funding level set for this year? And what are they putting that budget into? And why are we not getting a new turf for the football field? Or why are we not having an art program this year? I know it really does is what affects most people's lives on a huge amount every day.
What do you make of, speaking of the trust in the media, there is a difference. Number one, on the basis of party, okay, the plummeting of trust. I'm looking at some numbers here. Republican, lean Republican, national news went in 2016 from 70% now to 40% in Republicans, whereas Democrats 83-78, and so that's not really even a significant drop. And is it? I mean, I think I sort of know part of the answer, and that is that most of the national media is Democrat-oriented, liberal-oriented. But I mean, I sort of wonder, why is that? Is it that people that are Republican, self-identified, are also sort of more independent thinking or more critical or more skeptical? I mean, what is the explanation of that?
Well, it's hard not to look at the media, the national media, and not see that bias, right? And this gets back to my point about needing more people from different walks of life coming into journalism. I think one unfortunate thing is a lot of people who take themselves off to journalism school are done so for always for the same reasons. They're not necessarily fascinated by the craft of journalism or the idea of sort of holding truth. Well, they are motivated by holding truth to power, but only one side. They view themselves as these sort of liberal avengers, and they're going to go set the world straight and right. And that's the kind of uniform stereotype model you get coming in to journalism. And I think you...
Right. It's advocacy rather than news reporting.
And that fall off of GOP trust. Look, I remember I've been doing this a long time. And even when I started in journalism, there were panels that I would sit on and we would talk about liberal bias in the media. Okay, that's not a new thing. What fundamentally changed, though, about 8 years ago when Donald Trump came on the scene is that the press corps, very much to its discredit, decided to go from what I would call a gentle liberal bias, sort of almost the bias that they might not even realize they had. The problem that they had is just everybody thought that way, and so they thought that way too. To outright advocacy, to deciding that you were going to choose one political side and you were going to go all in on that political side and you were going to abandon any of the basic precepts of journalism, in particular, the number one precept, which is that you exist to ride herd on government. You do not take dictation from it. And once that was gone, that's how you end up with the Russia collusion hoax. It's how you end up with all of this reporting that's been, you know, the 51 Intel analysts and Hunter Biden's, you know, supposedly fake laptop. It's been one embarrassment after another for the media because they aren't following the story. They're being given political dictation.
I sort of also wonder, though, you know, okay, well, I was a little kid and there were basically three networks on TV. There was no social media and there was a local station. And, you know, this is the what I will call the Walter Cronkite era. And, you know, I sort of wonder it. What's happened recently makes me question if I was being fed editorialized, filtered news, or if it was objective. And there was no, because we didn't know. Nobody knew. There was no alternative. And it's clear that when you think back at CBS, NBC, and ABC, which were the networks, they sort of all reported the same stuff. We did trust it. The trust was high, but that doesn't mean it was necessarily trustworthy. And I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, I think that this is the flip side of everything we're talking about. And it's the upside of it is that we no longer, I wouldn't want to go back to the days of three media outlets.
Right.
Where essentially what was said on the evening broadcast was all the news you got. Now, you did get newspapers that had different opinions as well. There were different perspectives. They broke news in different ways. But we have this flourishing out there of news at the moment. And if you find somebody who's really dedicated, especially social media, it's remarkable. If you go online, sometimes these moments, they come out, something is reported, and then people are all over it, and they're giving you a different way of looking at it, information that wasn't available before. They're pulling out Freedom of Information Act papers and showing you different things. It's harder because you have to devote time to it and look through it and understand it. And there is a lot of wrong information out there as well, too, and you have to be on guard against it. But if we're just talking about transparency and the ability of people to have access to information at enormous amounts and levels, we're living in a whole new world, which I think is generally for the good.
Do you think that how close are we to having the daily news be more the online source? Looking at the Twitter or X or anything else that comes along, as opposed to TV. I sort of, you know, I'm still somebody that I don't really want to be online even as much as I am. And I tape news shows and we watch them later in the evening or whatever. I wonder how many people are going to be looking at the TV 5 or 10 years from now for daily news, because it's certainly true that the ability, the capability of updating minute by minute, it's all about online.
I'm not going to be brave enough to make any guesses about what online, what the media environment looks like 10 years from now. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I think about to what it looked like 10 years ago, this is extraordinary. It's been a sea change. People do love their TV, but we're also dealing with generational changes. You know, I'll tell you, I did a sort of teaching stint at a very brief thing at Hillsdale College some years back, where I did just a little course on editorial writing. And even back then, it was fascinating. I remember asking these amazing kids who were in my class. It was such an eye opener. But I was like, how many of you have a subscription to a newspaper? And absolutely not. And then I asked, well, you know, do you go to one news source and sort of read all the stories that they have that day? Absolutely not. I asked them, well, how do you get your news? And by and large, they agreed that their news that they read and partook of was news that had been sent to them by their friends on text or social media, which is fascinating if you think about it, because then your news that you're getting is almost entirely circumscribed by the circle of friends you have and their interests. I think we just have a long way to go before we understand how some of this all settles out.
Yeah, it's still very much in flux. I agree with you. Thank you for listening to part one of my discussion with today's guest, Kim Strassel, on The Independent with Scott Atlas. Stay tuned for part two.